MSW Media.
The Confederacy Society? He was like, no, no, the Federal Society. I said, oh, yeah, I'm not joining the Fascist Society. No, that's not going to happen. So.
Prevail. Це щотижнева програма про політику.
L'histoire, la sécurité nationale.
Crimine organizzato, dinero sucio.
Globale corruzione. Та боротьбу за демократію.
E ora?
A te.
E maintenant?
Con ustedes, su anfitrión.
Gregoria.
Welcome back to the fight. This time I know our side will win.
I'm Greg Oliar. This is Prevail. We've got a great show. Lisa Graves is here. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp Therapy Online. If you want to live a more empowered life, therapy can get you there. Visit betterhelp.com/Greg today to get 10% off your first month. If you like what I'm doing on the podcast, please subscribe, review, download, and share episodes with your friends. The Prevail column on Substack has been going since November of 2019, somehow. Lots of stuff in the archives about Leonard Leo, Brett Kavanaugh, Jared Kushner, Putin, Trump, Russia, Ukraine, much, much more. Every piece of Prevail is free to read and always will be. No paywalls ever. Your generous support keeps it that way. Subscriptions are just $6 a month, $55 a year. Visit gregoliar.substack.com to learn more. Lisa Graves is the founder and executive director of True North Research, a national investigative watchdog group that exposes the shadowy machinations of dark money funders like Leonard Leo, Barry Side, Harlan Crowe, Charles Koch, Dick Uihlein, and their front groups. For that, she served as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Policy Development at the U.S. Department of Justice under Attorneys General Janet Reno and John Ashcroft. She was the Chief Counsel for Nominations for Senator Patrick Leahy on the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee. She was Deputy Chief of the Article III Judges Division of the Administrative Office of the U.S. Courts with oversight of the Financial Disclosure Office, and a lot more. She also launched the award-winning AlecExposed.org investigation, Koch Docs, and other projects. Her op-eds have run in the most prominent newspapers and magazines in the country. She's a frequent guest on MSNBC. From 2009 to 2017, she led the Center for Media and Democracy, and she's still on the board there. Great talk this week with Lisa. You know, she was right in the center of things going on as the Supreme Court was being shaped, the current Supreme Court, right? She was in the thick of the Brett Kavanaugh stuff, the emails that that Pat Leahy was talking about during the confirmation are actually emails that some of which she wrote that got stolen, which she tells all that story later on. We delve a little bit more into Kavanaugh's finances and just how, you know, just what a bad decision it is to have that guy in the court and, you know, just an affront to democracy and women. And we talk a lot about John Roberts. She's working on a book about John Roberts, which I'm excited to read. And she spotted this guy from the get-go. She knew who he was right off the bat. She could tell he was dangerous because he was charming and smiley and presented as not a radical reactionary weirdo, even though, he is a radical reactionary weirdo. He's like, you know, the nice face of, let's call it what it is, fascism. This guy just likes to destroy voting rights. That's basically his entire legacy is destroying voting rights, giving corporations money to, you know, influence political campaigns and making sure that more kids die of guns. That's basically the John Roberts legacy. Oh, right. He also fucked up the impeachment trials because he didn't take them seriously. So he's awful. And Lisa has a lot of insight about that. And then we talk about Ginny and Clarence because we have to talk about Ginny and Clarence. No podcast talking about Supreme Court corruption can be complete without talking about Clarence Thomas. Really the most corrupt. I don't even know what to say about him at this point. I mean, it's just awful. And, you know, Roberts, again, ain't doing nothing to stop it, is he? Not a damn thing. We talk about that too, and how ridiculous it is that this guy, whose wife was involved in the insurrection, has not recused himself. It's sort of quaint and naive of us to think that Clarence Thomas would ever recuse himself for any reason whatsoever. This is a guy who's rinsed these billionaires for so much money, we can't even imagine how much, who, you know, lives this like jet-setting lifestyle by bending the rules to the point where they're break in half. We think that this guy is going to somehow find his ethical backbone and recuse himself. No way. There's no way. That's what they're paying him to do, is weigh in on these, you know, cases. So maybe they're not paying him directly to do that, but they're giving him money. They're giving him stuff, and they expect something in return for all the investment they've put into him. So if you think he's ever going to recuse himself from anything, I mean, I have a $250,000 RV to sell you. Anyway, it's a great conversation with Lisa. She's terrific. You will enjoy this. There's absolutely no way that you will not enjoy this, this conversation. So up front, I don't have much. Tish James says that the state of New York, my state of New York, is going to begin seizing assets on March 25th, which is very soon. She's going to seize the assets of Donald Trump. And my question is, where is she going to begin? Will she first take Mike Johnson or Ron Johnson? Bah, bah. Yeah, he's got a lot of assets, doesn't he? Just not money ones. I mean, this guy is so broke. If it weren't for these tax laws about real estate, he would have been broke a long, long time ago. And we get on this a little bit in the discussion, too, about debt and being in money trouble and how that's potentially a big national security issue when you have positions of great, you know, importance, like, say, oh, I don't know, president. Maybe you shouldn't be in that position where you're blackmailable, to use the term that Lisa uses. You know, maybe not a great idea. Lev Parnas testified in front of the House. It's another one of these Comer. I've lost track of these Jim Comer impeachment hearings. They're such a waste of time, other than they usually backfire on the guys. It's like in a cartoon where they light the cigar and the cigar goes, you know, blows up in their face. This is like what he is. Comer is a walking cigar that blows up in your face. Like, he's trying to help and he can't. First of all, because he's got nothing on Biden. And second of all, because he just sucks at this. He's awful at it. I mean, really a joke. I mean, there's no way. I mean, can Trump watch this guy and be like, I like that guy? I mean, he's awful, just awful. But Lev Parnas in the hearing basically said, yeah, these guys knew all about what was going on in Ukraine. They knew that the Russians were pushing the stuff. They knew they were spreading disinformation, and they didn't care as long as it fit the narrative. That's what he said. As long as it fit the narrative, you know, that Biden was dirty or whatever, they didn't care where the information came from or whether or not it was true. And he name-checked Ron Johnson. I was very excited about this back in December of 2019. So very early on in my Prevail columns, I wrote a piece about what I call the 4th of July traitors, who are the eight lawmakers, all Republicans, who celebrated the 4th of July of 2018 in Moscow, Russia. This was Richard Shelby of Alabama. He was the leader of the delegation. And then you had some senators. You had Ron Johnson. You had John Neely Kennedy of Louisiana. You had Steve Daines from Montana. North Dakota's John Haven. Jerry Moran of Kansas. John Thune from South Dakota. And then the only House member was Representative Kay Granger of the 12th District of Texas. And if you want to go through and read what happened there, because it's kind of funny in hindsight, this is what Kennedy said. Kennedy and Daines said they were there. The delegation, this is from Daines, quote, sent a very strong message and a direct message to the Russian government, end quote, and in which they requested that Russia stop fucking with, first, our elections, second, Ukraine, and three, Syria. Kennedy said, quote, I asked our friends in Russia not to interfere in our elections this year. I asked them to exit Ukraine and allow Ukraine to self-determine. I asked for the same thing in Crimea. I asked for their help in bringing peace to Syria, and I asked them not to allow Iran to gain a foothold in Syria. So, obviously, this had so much effect on Putin and his guys. They were like, oh, great. Well, if Senator Kennedy says we should leave Ukraine alone, well, I guess we're going to leave Ukraine alone. I mean, what a joke. What a pathetic joke. But it's also notable that two Republican senators actually tried to protect Ukraine and made it important in 2018. What's happened in the meantime, I wonder, other than Putin invading it and causing this horrible war and all this death and destruction and rape and pillage and horror? Now the Republicans are for it. They don't want to help Ukraine anymore. I don't know. It's very, very strange. Very, very strange. Also, you know, there's this claim of the Republicans and Trump, like, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? And I just remind everybody, 4 years ago this week, Trump was giving a press conference in which he said we should, I think, put bleach up our ass to kill COVID. And also the death rates for COVID were actually very low, you know, as that Deborah Blix looked on saying nothing, you know, intent in her complicity as this pandemic raged and people couldn't get toilet paper and all this kind of stuff. So no, objectively speaking, no one was better off 4 years ago. No one. So that talking point is just kind of stupid. Anyway, all right, I don't want to talk too much up front. Lisa's great. I want to get to that so that you could enjoy that conversation. We will be right back with Lisa Graves.
What do you get for the man who has everything? You know who I'm talking about. He's already got a Patek Philippe, a Picasso, an Airbus 380. I mean, what do you get for a guy like that? Well, have you thought about buying him a Supreme Court justice? Hi, I'm Leonard Leo. I run the Federalist Society and the Judicial Crisis Network, and honestly, there's so many of these organizations I lose track, but I'm basically a real estate broker only for Supreme Court justices. I know, it sounds crazy, but Supreme Court justices are cheaper than you think. One time, my client acquired one in exchange for a Washington Nationals season ticket package. Supreme Court justices make great gifts. Wait till you see the look on his face when he opens his very own Sam Alito. Want to buy a Supreme Court justice? Just head over to my eBay store, which is ebay.com/KnightOfMaltaScotusPimp, and click Buy Now. Enter promo code BOOF to get 10% off your first purchase. You won't be sorry. Believe me, a Picasso ain't nothing next to a Gorsuch. It's the gift that keeps on giving. And now, back to the show.
Lisa Graves, welcome to Prevail.
Thank you so much, Greg, for inviting me. I'm thrilled to be on your podcast with you.
Yeah, it's nice to see you again. You were on the 5-8, I think, 2 weeks ago. Today, by the way, is St. Patrick's Day, which neither of us realized when we scheduled this. And now that we know that it is, neither of us care. So, but thank you for, you know, coming on St. Patrick's Day to hang out.
Sure.
We covered a lot of stuff on that episode. And I wanted to go deeper into some things. Before, though, you're the executive director of True North Research. So talk a little bit about that. What is it? How did it come to be? What's your role in it? What's the mission?
Sure. I launched True North as a research group to really focus in on who is obstructing progress, who is trying to rewrite the law, both federally and in the states, to make it harder for ordinary Americans, who's trying to restrict our freedoms. And so I chose the name True North because one of my great heroes is Frederick Douglass, and he had a paper called the North Star that was the great abolitionist paper. And I didn't feel like I could, you know, name my website after the great paper Frederick Douglass, but I could make a nod to it by, you know, taking a page from that in terms of True North, and True North meaning like a compass, like the true point of your philosophy or your or truth in essence. And so I chose True North for that reason. So me and my little research team, my team and I do a lot of work looking at sort of right-wing groups, right-wing operatives, right-wing funders, and those who have a very regressive or repressive view of people's freedom and are attempting to impose that repressive view through the law on other people. So that's sort of what we do.
I think I know some of these people. I think I know who some of them might be.
Yes.
The people you're studying, not the people who, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, we're encountering more and more of them, it appears. And the thing is that it's just so, interesting is one word to describe it, but it's such a contrast, because while some of these groups and individuals use the word freedom in their name, or they like to throw around the word freedom. In fact, their focus is really repression of other people's freedom. Yeah. It's like the opposite of freedom to tell someone else how to live their life or to intervene in someone else's medical decisions. I would never do that. It's just so shocking to me. It's so anti-freedom. And yet, you know, that's the language that they use. And I also have just deep respect for people having different, you know, philosophical points of view or religious beliefs or non-belief, atheism or agnosticism or other philosophies. But I just, I think that it's freedom to have that philosophy yourself in terms of how you live your life. But it's shocking to me that people would try to use the law to impose their religious beliefs on others as binding law. That's just anti-freedom to me.
Freedom, though, freedom is slavery. I think I read that in Orwell, I think, in 1984.
Yeah. So. Yeah, there was a book. Yeah, I do remember that book. Yeah, yeah.
That was a history book, right?
It turns out it was a predictive, sort of predictive history. Yeah.
Now, you study these people, like, you know, your Leonard Leo, who I've talked to death about on this podcast and elsewhere, and these other right wing kind of funding groups and dark money families and all this stuff. Do you feel like, how do you, you seem like you're a cheerful person, it seems like to me. So how do you spend all day reading about these horrible people and then not take it with you? Like, what can you recommend that I do to keep my sanity, I guess, is the question.
Well, you know, so I appreciate the compliment, by the way, but, you know, it is a real challenge. But the reality is that they didn't gain power overnight. This has been a long time coming, but I also think that there are tipping points, in terms of pushing back. We don't need to build a 50-year movement to counter them. And in part, that's because, man, it takes a long time to sell these lies. It takes a lot of money for Charles Koch, and Leonard Leo to sort of recast a restriction as freedom. It takes a lot of energy to recast greed or, you know, greed as prosperity. And so part of the reason I'm hopeful is that actually, when you survey the American people in the States and nationally, not with these polls that I think have been deeply distorted, but in general, when you ask them about issues, most Americans are much more aligned with progressive ideas across the board on almost every domestic issue. That's despite millions and millions and millions of dollars that have gone into trying to, you know, say the sky is pink, to try to say that, you know, greed is prosperity, to try to say that restriction is freedom. You know, in fact, they have not persuaded a majority in most places, nationally or in the States. And the other part of, I suppose, my hopefulness or my joy in the battle, I guess, is what's the alternative for me? You know, in my view, you know, either we fight and we push them back, or we fight and we don't prevail. But if we don't fight back, we have no chance of prevailing. Yeah. Not just to use the word of your podcast, this watchword, but I think of that regularly. Like, if you don't push back, they will surely win. And so I think, how can I help illuminate these issues? How can I help more and more people understand what's happening and know that they can change things, that we can change things. These are not preordained. This is not a preordained reality. We don't have to be here. It doesn't have to be this way. We can make choices. We can try to hold them to account. We can imagine a better future and work for it. And I think that's an inherently moral act, to work for a better future, whether you're able to see it for yourself or not, as so many civil rights leaders and other human rights leaders have done over time, not seeing the results of their labor necessarily, but building the structure or the ideas to help progress happen. But I'm hopeful to see more progress in my lifetime, and hopeful that we'll shake off this dark trend that has emerged. But I think, I guess the last thing I'll say on that, is that I find in my philosophy of life that worry is a thief of the joy in the present moment. And so is regret, you know, so is worrying about the past or worrying about the future. The only, you have to, action changes the future. Worry can really tie us down, bog us down, make us feel hopeless. But in fact, action can be, generate tremendous hope.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of looking at it. And thank you for answering that. And thank you for the work you're doing, because I think it's super important. I think
not enough people are doing it, frankly. And, you know, you're doing a great job with it. It reminded me when you were saying that there's a line from Andor where he says, I'd rather die fighting them than die giving them what they want. And I think that's, the, you know, that's the thing. It's like we do, to your point, we do have the numbers. It's not even progressive stuff that we're asking for either. It's just, it's not progressive to be like, maybe let the doctors handle this. You know, that's not progressive. Their stuff is wackadoodle reactionary as far as I see it.
That's right. You know, someone said to me, asked me once, like, am I a radical? And I was like, no, these are common sense things. Doctors and patients deciding, you know, the patient deciding their course of treatment, you know, like, most of these things I don't think of as radical or in some ways progressive, although I obviously just described them in that way because I see them as part of a progressive trend. Yeah. But so much of this is common sense. And what's happening now is not common sense. This idea that a frozen embryo is a minor child that is entitled to equivalent rights to, you know, to a child who is, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 years old, who can't be frozen indefinitely and brought back to life. Like, you know, I mean, it's just not common sense. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's, are we sure that it's a child? Is it like a Benjamin Button thing where it goes backward in time? And can the frozen embryo collect Social Security benefits? And what will they do when have to pay the frozen embryo Social Security benefits? Because they don't want to do that. I don't know. I'm just thinking out loud here.
In fact, the tax code changes in at least one of these states to try to imbue the frozen embryo with a tax benefit. It's just really quite, or fertilized egg with tax benefits. It's just extraordinary. And then this is happening at the same time that, you know, some of these same forces on the right are trying to destroy the actual language of the 14th Amendment, which I happen to have here, as I think I showed you last time. The 14th Amendment, which says in its opening line, it says all persons born or naturalized in the United States are subject to the jurisdiction and are citizens of the United States. Like, it literally says the people born in the United States are citizens. And these, some of these right-wingers, including Trump, want to destroy birthright citizenship. They want to say that if you're born here and one of your parents or a parent or parents weren't lawfully present here, that you're not a citizen. But the Constitution says you are. Like, that's just the plain language. I didn't make it up. It's not a progressive spin. It's just the way it is. And so they don't want people who are born here to have citizenship, but they want people who are fertilized here, but who may never actually be born to have the same, or, you know, to have rights of people who are born. It's just astonishing what's happening.
And it makes no sense. And the citizenship thing is never going to happen because Putin's sending too many pregnant Russians here to give birth. So that's not, Trump is never going to be allowed to fuck with that, I think. Now, we were talking about horrible people, and one of my favorite horrible people is Leonard Leo. So you went to Cornell Law School. Leonard Leo went to Cornell Law School. So are you guys like embarrassed about that? Because I went to Georgetown. We have a lot of bad people that went to Georgetown. Like Eric Trump went there and Paul Manafort went there. Chris Saliza. It's awful. There's bad people. There's good people too. But is there some sort of buzz in the Cornell law community? Like, holy shit, how did this happen? Or...
Well, that's a good question. You know, I definitely don't speak for the Cornell law community. I did at one point get an award from them for my public interest work. So that was nice. A little bit of recognition for some of the work I've done over the years. But it is strange to me, in essence, to think about the fact that given the fact that I've spent so much time investigating him and trying to have people understand what his agenda is and how he's operating, that we went to the same school. But we didn't overlap. He graduated a few years ahead of me. But not so far in the distance that I didn't go to the school and there was a Federalist Society chapter already there. I confess that when I was in college, I studied under a couple of amazing professors, Professor Freeman and Professor Beagle. One was very progressive, one was very restrictive. Professor Beagle was a fan of Scalia. Teaching from the Federalist Society sort of playbook. And so I had learned about the Federalist Society and about this so-called originalism, which I consider to be the dead hand, sort of a dead hand theory, trying to, you know, zombie law. But basically, so I got to the law school, and the first or second day I was there, I was standing in line for lunch or something. And some guy comes up to me and he's like, oh, are you going to join the Federalist Society? And I said, pardon me, like what, the Feudalist Society? And he was like, no, the Federalist Society. And I said, oh, like, you mean like the anti-federalists, like the ones who didn't actually believe in a national government, how this whole this states rights thing, like the Confederacy, And he was like, no, the Federalist Society. And I said, oh yeah, I'm not joining the Fascist Society. No, that's not going to happen. So that was sort of the end of that invitation to go join them. Yeah.
So you had this pegged very early. Okay. You knew exactly what they were. I don't get the name either so much. I thought that Federalists wanted a strong federal government and now they don't. It all speaks to this non-logic. None of it makes sense to me. It really doesn't. So then you went and you worked at the DOJ. Okay, because I said, yeah. I want to talk about what you were doing there. You worked in something called the Office of Policy Development in legal policy. So my question is, what exactly does that entail, and what were you doing at the time, and did you have any possible ability to influence whether or not we can try an existing sitting president under the law? Did you see the memo?
Well, so I after Cornell, I did clerk for a year, and then I went to work at the Justice Department, and then eventually, within a couple of years, I ended up in the Office of Policy Development, which is now called the Office of Legal Policy. And it's a senior leadership position within the Justice Department. If you have a sense of some component of the Justice Department, the part that many people have heard of is the Office of Legal Counsel, which is where John Yoo ultimately was during the Bush administration when he did the torture memos. The Office of Legal Counsel is the part of DOJ that says, is something constitutional or not? Is this permissible? And the Office of Legal Policy or Policy Development, our job is to say, just because it's constitutional doesn't mean it's a good idea. You know, just because you can do it doesn't mean you should do it. We had at one point we had these little buttons that said that just because it's constitutional doesn't mean it's a good idea. So it was really a dream job. I was working with so many wonderful people like LD Acheson. She was the assistant attorney general. Harry Lipman was there for a time. He's sometimes on MSNBC. He was a deputy assistant attorney general. I eventually became deputy assistant attorney general there. And I used to describe that job as being paid to say whether something was a good idea or not, which was just like, if I was a rich person, I would pay for that. You know, can I just tell you whether something is a good idea? But that's really simplified because in fact, even on your professional evaluation, it was, you know, can you discern the difference between a superficially appealing idea and one that's actually something that could be accomplished or implemented? And so I worked on a lot of civil and criminal policies, including gun policy after Columbine and judicial nominations. I did not see some secret memo that says that says anything like presidents have unlimited immunity forever and ever and ever, but even for things that happened before, during, and after, doesn't exist. Certainly not in the Constitution. It's not a real thing. It's been rejected every time anyone has even asserted like this sort of partial notion, like the Nixonian version of it, let alone Trump's absurd assertion of it. It does not exist. Does not exist. It's not a thing.
Okay. I didn't think so. And thank you for answering that, because to me, I mean, I think of the DOJ as this very monolithic thing, because I'm not a lawyer. I didn't go to law school. I think I have a copy of the Constitution somewhere in this room, but I don't have it handy. You know, I don't know which amendments are. I don't even know how many there are. You know, I think there's at least one and two. I know what those are.
Yes. Yes.
You know, explaining how it works in there is actually very helpful, because, you know, we just, people don't know. I don't know. And I assume other people don't know. So thank you for delving into that. You're working for the Administrative Office of U.S. Courts. Is that what I think it is, which is the U.S. court system, like all of the circuit courts and all that federal stuff? That's that, right? Or no?
Yeah. Yeah. So okay. When I was at Justice, I was a career deputy. So what that meant was one of my jobs mostly after the Supreme Court issued its ruling in Bush versus Gore and shut down the recount that ultimately would have established that Gore had won Florida. My job was to help with the orderly transition in government, which was to advise the incoming administration on policy issues, including judicial nominations, human trafficking. Those are issues I worked on, Violence Against Women Act issues, gun policy, and the like. So I stayed, I was there when they came in after inauguration, Ted Cruz and these other folks came through the door, and the gun policy team suddenly became 12 guys and me. It's the only woman. The first gun policy meeting, the person who was in charge of it said, "Well, gentlemen and lady, we've accomplished a lot today. And Ashcroft was soon coming in the door. I could tell you stories about Ashcroft. It was so there was this moment where I thought about, you know, could I stay? And I was concerned if I stayed, I would just make them sound more reasonable, you know, by basically trying to, you know, rationalize or ameliorate some of the stuff they're going to do. But they were going to do whatever they're going to do anyway. For example, a couple weeks in, the gun policy team didn't have a meeting. So I thought it was canceled, basically. And then the next gun policy meeting, they talked about how fun it was at the last gun policy meeting that they went to the NRA's shooting range to go shoot guns for the hour.
So you didn't go to that?
I was not invited to that part of the gun policy meeting. So anyway, I was like, oh, I've got to get out of here. I have to get out of here. And when January 20th, on the 19th, I helped walk Ms. Reno out the door along with my boss, the assistant attorney general, left the building that night, not sure what was going to happen next, because the next week, then all the political appointees were gone. Anyone who was a person who was confirmed or what they call a Schedule C employee. And so I was one of the last people in the top of the Department of Justice still there. And it was just a surreal experience. And so I started looking for a job. I ended up getting hired by the Administrative Office of the U.S. Courts, which you've asked about. And it's the body that in the third branch of government that supports the judges. There's I was the deputy chief of the Article III Judges Division, meaning assisting all the lifetime appointed judges at the appellate courts and the district courts. There's like a magistrate judges division. There's a bankruptcy judges division. But the division that I was in was responsible for providing policy and administrative support for the lifetime appointed judges, which included helping to train them for becoming a chief judge in their district or circuit. It also involved what now sounds a little quaint, but there was this thing called the Russian Leadership Program, which was but at the time it was after the fall of the Soviet Union, and there was this sort of warm relationship before Putin, where there was an attempt by the Library of Congress and these other branches to really support transparency in the Soviet Union. So they had these exchanges of Russian judges who would come over to the U.S. to learn about our system and how we could have anti-corruption measures, how to have things that would prevent against the corruption of the courts. Very quaint now in both respects, both the American respect and the Russian end of things. But that was my job. I was the deputy chief over there, and I oversaw the Financial Disclosure Office, which had a team that reviewed these financial disclosure forms, like of the Supreme Court justices and others. And so it all became very relevant in my subsequent work.
Yeah, I saw that, and my eyeballs are picked up, my ears picked up, my eyeballs. What's the expression? I don't know.
Your ears perked up. My ears perked up,
but my eyes.
Your eyeballs popped.
But they didn't pop out. Yeah. I was like, I know what that means now. Because
perked up. Yeah.
I perked up. financial disclosure is, of course, all about Brett Kavanaugh in my life, anyway, because I've written about him extensively with my friend LB back in whenever that was, early 2020.
2018, yep.
It happened in 18, but we wrote about it in 2020. And did you have any dealings with any of these people that we now know back when they were, like, you know, not quite established yet? Like, did you give orientations to Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett and stuff? Or is it too big for that and you don't have any, you know?
Well, because I was the staff counsel basically for the committee on nominations within the Justice Department, I spent a lot of time reviewing potential nominees of the Clinton administration, which included some Republican people who were supported by Trent Lott and other Republicans who were trying to, you know, put their nominees forward or potential nominees forward. So I spent a lot of time reviewing the records of people who could be judges, including their financial records, and if they were sitting judges, their financial disclosures. At that time in 2001, into right before I joined the Senate Judiciary Committee, Kavanaugh had gone over to the White House, so Coney Barrett had just graduated from law school a few years earlier, had worked on Bush v. Gore, as apparently did Kavanaugh,
and Roberts, everybody
had been advising Jeb Bush, et cetera. But I did encounter Kavanaugh a couple different ways. One was I actually ended up debating him at some event that's no longer preserved in recording in DC, along with, I think, C. Boyd and Gray was there. But then what happened was my files were stolen, along with a number of other Senate staffers. Senator Kinney's staffers, Senator Biden's staffers, Senator Durbin's staffers were taken by a Hatch staffer for a guy, Senator Hatch's staffer, who then became a staffer for Senator Frist, and then gave those files to Brett Kavanaugh, at least some subset of those files to Brett Kavanaugh. We didn't know that at the time, didn't know that the files were stolen. But in fact, what had happened was we learned that they were stolen in November of 2003, and then Kavanaugh was nominated as the Senate investigation into those, the taking of those files was kind of concluded. And the person who had taken these files or arranged for them to be provided to him, had originally taken them, refused to cooperate with the investigation and refused to tell the investigators who at the White House he gave the files to. We suspected it was Brett Kavanaugh. And so when he was nominated for the DC circuit, we asked those questions. Those questions were posed through senators. Did you receive any of these files? In fact, even Hatch asked the question because it was just so outrageous what had happened to the Senate Judiciary Committee. To this day, it's why that committee has their email addresses, judiciary-dem and judiciary-rep, because the server had to be segregated because of, you know, how this went down. And so Kavanaugh said he had no, you know, he never received anything, never received any of these files. He lied, in my view.
No way. No.
He was asked in writing, declined, you know, said no. And then we held him, you know, at the staff recommendation, senators held him. He didn't get confirmed in 2004. After I left the Senate Judiciary Committee, he was renominated and ultimately he was confirmed to the DC circuit. But again, he was asked, did he receive these files? The thing about the files is, they were clearly our internal documents. They were whistleblower materials. They were our scheduling materials. They were my memos, basically, of every terrible thing some Bush nominee had done. They were my memos on the procedure for the Senate. And even if theoretically Kavanaugh had no idea that these files were somehow taken from the Democrats, once there was a public investigation, the fact that these files were stolen, there was a recommendation that charges be brought against the people involved, although the Bush administration didn't do so. At the time that he testified, he would have known for certain then that he had received these files that included files that were written by me. And so then when he was testifying for his Senate nomination in 2018, I was sitting at my house in Wisconsin and he said he didn't know, you know, he didn't receive any stolen files. And I was shocked. So I wrote a piece for Slate that said he shouldn't be elevated. He should be impeached for lying to the Senate. So I did encounter Brett Kavanaugh.
I didn't even know about that lie. Wow. That's good yeah. stuff. So I'm just trying yeah. to think what would be the purpose of stealing the file? And stealing them, meaning that you guys no longer have access to them, like in that sort of way?
No, stealing them, taking copies okay. of them. So they would know in advance of our right. sequence of hearings. They would know what information we had about their, like our memos about problems with their nominees, so they could prepare for that.
Right.
They would know in the instance of some of the other staffers, communications that they've sent to their bosses about how they think, you know, their assessment of these nominees. So there were times in that period from 2002 to late 2003 where something would happen in Senate Judiciary Committee, and I'd think, wow, like how do they know that? That's weird. Like we're not talking about that. We talked about that internally, you know, in memos, but it didn't come forward for this meeting or this hearing. And so it happened a couple of times and I think, oh, that's so weird. Like, why are they saying that? But we didn't think, never occurred to us that they were in the files and taking our files and had this whole scheme to take our files. The person who was the key ringleader of this lost his job basically with Frist, was condemned by Hatch. There was a recommendation that he'd be charged. But this being the George W. Bush administration, what happened was he was then a little while later appointed to be the rule of law advisor to the head of U.S. operations in Iraq. So that was a shock. Then he was rewarded by CPAC, the conservative PAC from ACU, the American Conservative Union. He was awarded the Ronald Reagan Award for his defense of the judiciary. So they rewarded him for his conduct. And then, of course, he also got a gig for a time writing op-eds for the Wall Street Journal's editorial page, which is notoriously in the tank for whatever right-wing, you know.
James Taranto and Leonard Leo.
Yes.
Wrote a book together.
Exactly.
They wrote a book together.
Exactly. You know? Exactly.
They're buds. I don't know that sending somebody to Iraq is necessarily not punishing them, maybe. But, you know, I could see that being like a kind of a, well, you know. But so was this happening? Like, it wasn't a one-time thing. They were doing it sort of for a while this was going on, or it was like one break-in? Yeah.
No, they were doing it over the course of more than 2 years. They found a way into the Democrats' files, and then they were routinely going in there and taking copies of the files and then sharing them with select individuals, including Brett Kavanaugh.
Oh, my
so,
God.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, and then, you know, anyway, and there was the Washington Post fact checker looked into, you know, what I said, what he claimed. And then at one point during the hearings, before the news broke about Dr. Christine Blasey Ford, Kavanaugh claimed that he switched his lie from he didn't receive anything to saying, oh, but it was just normal to receive these types of memos and intel about, and the Judiciary Committee at that time in 2003, 2004, it was the most heated battle in the entire Senate. They were determined to try to get their nominees through, try to get Roberts through, Miguel Estrada, Kavanaugh, others through to pack the bench. And the Democrats were united in opposing that and trying to block the worst of the worst. And so it was the most pitched battle. It's not like a piece of legislation where you're having a conversation like, oh, you know, what about this sentence and this provision of the law and negotiating? There was no negotiating. It was, sort of hand-to-hand combat on the nominations issues, and we would never have ever shared those memos with them or the White House. And the White House was attacking us relentlessly, and their proxies out there in the judicial nominations umbrella that Leonard Leo led, they were relentlessly attacking the members, calling them anti-Catholic, anti-Christian, anti-woman, anti-Latino, anti-immigrant, like anti-anything, basically. When we would, when the Democrats would stand up against one of these nominees. And so I, along with a couple of my colleagues who were on Senate Judiciary at the time, wrote an op-ed in Time magazine to say, this is just another lie of Brett Kavanaugh that shows his moral unfitness for this job, that he is completely distorting what everyone knew at the time about the Judiciary Committee. And he clearly had access to our secret memos, including whistleblower letters.
I think those were emails that he regularly received along with the dirty jokes from Justice Kaczynski's server that he also denies being on or knowing anything about.
So Kavanaugh, you know, they only released a portion of the emails from Kavanaugh from the White House. His friend held back a number of them, in fact, thousands of documents. So these few that showed that Manny Miranda, who's the person who was the Hatch staffer, was telling him he had to meet with him, had documents to share with him, and was sharing a memo of mine in particular that I wrote. It took, you know, hundreds of hours to write about one of the key issues that we were fighting them on. We don't know everything from those files because they shut it down. And then that person, one of his best friends at the White House, who was the gatekeeper then for materials that was shared with the Senate, Bill Burke, he has reappeared recently. Not that he was not always in existence as in mortal form, but he reappeared recently because he's on the board of this thing called Cause of Action, which is the group that is trying to destroy the Chevron deference doctrine. Mm. And he was also in a brief that was before, or at least an effort to get a case before the Supreme Court in the past few months, which is the Koch Industries case involving the climate change suit in Minnesota. And Kavanaugh did not recuse himself from that suit. But so here you have a guy who is the gatekeeper keeping these materials about the communications from Judge Kaczynski, communications about from Manny and others about our secret files that Manny had taken and other matters. That person has then long been helping a Koch group, a very strongly Koch-tied group, Cause of Action, and was on the board even during this period in which he was being the gatekeeper on these documents, and then now shows up as the attorney on this climate change brief that the court rejected the case, at least for now. But, so a Koch Industries lawyer is who Bill Burke is now. Yeah.
I can't there's so much rank corruption with this guy that it sort of boggles the mind.
It's like, I always like this question of like, you know, there's like legal corruption, there's bribery, there's moral corruption, there's lack of ethic. There's this whole range of things depending on which incident you're talking about. Like, where does it fall in these different legal categories or actionable categories or just moral categories? But the thing that I just think about Kavanaugh, including his debt that mysteriously disappeared, which you know you've written about and more, it's that it's just this culture of corruption and entitlement. And just to have two men on the court in Thomas and in Kavanaugh who had, you know, in Kavanaugh's instance, though he denied it, had attempted to sexually assault a person, Christine Blasey Ford, and, you know, in the case of Thomas, had just engaged in grotesque sexual overtures and totally inappropriate behavior towards someone whose career was relied on him. And it's just amazing that these two men are even on our highest court in the country, let alone some of the others who are there now. But yeah.
Thank you for saying that, because it's a disgrace is what it is. It's an affront to women, and it's a disgrace. There's no reality in which there's a dirty joke mass email chain going out and Brett Kavanaugh is not on it in that thing. There's just, he's the target audience for this shit. Okay, we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Okay.
With Lisa Graves.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp Therapy Online. For 10% off your first month, go to betterhelp.com/Greg. What's the first thing you'd do if you had an extra hour in your day? I always wish I had more time. I've got so many things to do and not enough time to do them. Probably I would sleep. It would be great to have like one more hour of sleep. I would love to spend an hour concentrated on reading books. That would be great. You know, there's lots of things to do. We could just binge another episode of The Bear or whatever. You know, a lot of us spend our lives wishing we had more time. But like, time for what? If time was unlimited, how would you use it? The best way to squeeze that special thing into your schedule is to know what's important to you and make that thing a priority. And sometimes, I mean, it seems simple, right? Like, what's important to you? Well, you should know, but sometimes it's hard to know. You know, it's hard to really, there's so many responsibilities that we have in modern life that it can be hard to really know and understand what's important and what we want. You know, what do we really want? What do you really want? Therapy can help you find out what matters to you, so you can do more of it. You know, it's a real thing. I've always had problems of what I want, really. You know, if you could do anything, anywhere, at any time, what would you be doing? I don't know. I think I would be doing this right now. I'd be talking to you guys on my podcast. That's what I would be doing. Therapy can help you find what matters to you, so you could do more of it. You know, therapy is helpful for learning positive coping skills, how to set boundaries. It empowers you to be the best version of yourself. You know, it isn't just for those who have experienced major trauma. That's a myth. Anybody can benefit from therapy. Anybody. Anybody at all. There's not a human on earth that could not benefit from therapy. I am a big believer in it. And I think BetterHelp is a great way to access therapy. You know, it's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient and flexible and suited to your schedule. And what I really like about it is that it's quick. You know, relatively speaking, it's you find a therapist very quickly, because I find that people that are taking the step to go to therapy, usually there's a reason why, and they want to get to the therapist as soon as possible so they can start accessing the benefits. And BetterHelp, you know, hooks you up pretty quickly. So you just fill out a brief questionnaire, you get matched with a licensed therapist, you switch therapists at any time, no additional charge. So learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/Greg today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Greg. Start living a better life today.
Hi, this is John Cryer, and I am hosting a new 7-part true crime podcast called Lawyers, Guns, and Money that'll challenge everything you think you know about U.S. covert operations and presidential misconduct. From Jack Bryan, the director of American PSYOP, comes the incredible true story of John Mattis, a newly sworn-in Miami public defender in the 1980s who has found himself completely in over his head.
I step off the plane, and there is a van with a couple guys with Uzis. And one of them in broken English said, "Welcome to Bogota, John."
Mattis's first felony defendant has been arrested for having a machine gun and tells Mattis a dangerous secret.
He was shipping arms into Central America on behalf of the CIA. As a first-time lawyer, I want to act like I know what I'm doing.
But with the help of a Colombian drug smuggler...
How much money the CIA raised by hitting up drug dealers?
A lot of money, millions of dollars.
An Alabama mercenary...
They were prepared to die to the last man. I saw this in them. I saw the fire in their eyes. And they made me their war chief.
And a newly elected senator, John Kerry.
We are looking at allegations of drug running, gun smuggling, conspiracy to commit murder and murder itself.
He'll fight to free his client.
The judge said, show me in a courtroom how we were at war.
Expose an illegal war being run by the White House.
I mean, I wanted him involved, but I didn't want to be on record as doing it.
And somehow stay alive in the process.
I just escaped a kidnapping by the CIA in Costa Rica.
This is Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
So you have a man in an Armani suit standing on the bow of a boat with a rocket launcher and says, if I lose sight of you, I will launch. You will be vaporized.
Available everywhere starting October 29th, or get it ad-free and early starting October 22nd at lawyersgunsandmoney.supercast.com. There you'll find bonus episodes along with exclusive content. Subscribe now.
Okay, we're back with Lisa Graves. Before the break, we were talking about Brett Kavanaugh. I know that you did a lot of work with these financial disclosures. So we wrote, when we wrote our pieces about Kavanaugh, we spent a lot of time looking at his money. And everybody knows about the down payment, which was about $250,000 down, which was money he flat out did not have. And when asked about it under oath, he said, oh, I have this trust. It's called the government trust, whatever this 401k for the government is called. And, you know, the money was from that, but he had like 50 grand in there, if that. So, it, you know, again, I'm not a math major, but it was a lot less.
Yeah.
And so, but he kept saying these things and nobody really pushed him that much. But I know there's rules in the way that you can disclose things, that if somebody close to you gives you money like that, like his dad was when he bought that house, his father had just left from his cozy lobbying job with a $14 million golden parachute exit package. Yeah. So he has one kid. He's got the two grandkids. It's almost certainly that's the person that you would think would have given him the money for the down payment.
Right.
And I think because it's his dad, he doesn't have to say so externally. Is that right? Because I've been taking a task on this by people on.
Well, you know, there's
at
been
Mother
this,
Jones actually. But okay,
yeah. there's a statute about gifts that applies to all federal employees, and it's been in existence I think since 77, 78. But there's been this general notion that you can take a gift. There is a gift exception, but its purpose is basically that you don't have to disclose if your parents or your best friend from high school brings you a cake, you know, and brings, you know, like has you for a birthday party. You have to disclose like a birthday party or something like that. But it's become this thing that seems like a gigantic loophole. And the thing about Kavanaugh and that and the debt and the payment and more for me, and I definitely defer to your expertise, Greg, in terms of all the details of it. But the easiest thing in the world would have been to say, yeah, my parents helped us out. Like, why not
just
say it?
Happens. What I'm getting
and so not saying it, I think puts a cloud over it.
Yeah.
It leads to a reasonable concern that it wasn't his parents. It wasn't his dad, though he had plenty of
exactly.
money.
Exactly. That's the point I've been making. Right. Yeah. Why not just say so? Is he just trying to troll me? He's trolling us.
Right.
He wants to give me content for this podcast 7 years later. Just tell the truth, man. And, you know, frankly, if it's his dad, I want to know who he owes money to, because he owes money to somebody, you know.
Well, And that's the thing. So when I used to read FBI files and I read, you know, dozens and dozens of them, the FBI investigation. So at the Justice Department, during that period, we would like when we sent out the name of the nominee to the FBI to do their FBI background investigation, we would do our own vet in which we would be looking at everything about them that we could find. This was sort of pre-Google, but there was still material that was findable. And we made a bunch of calls, dozens of calls to people in the community, people they worked for. I added to that process to make sure that we were talking not just to the law firm partners or the judge down the hall that they golf with, but the secretaries and paralegals and law clerks, so that we could get a real sense of how they treated people who didn't have power, who they might have lorded power over. But we would do an evaluation of their temperament, their legal acumen, their fairness. And then these FBI files would come in about 30 days later. And the FBI file was not as thorough as you might imagine. It was thorough in the sense of, like, every place you lived, they would check, did you live there? Every employer you had, were you employed there? What did you do? And they would ask these questions, sort of three questions. There were sort of five questions, but like the three that were most germane were basically about, one was, in essence, have you ever belonged to a club that discriminated based on race or gender? You know, they want to know if they've discriminated. Then they had another question, which was about whether they'd ever done drugs of any kind, when, where, how. That was a question that was really based on blackmail ability. And then they would ask a question about whether you've ever worked with an organization devoted to the violent overthrow of the American government. Seemed like an archaic question back then, increasingly yeah. relevant now. But the through line with that FBI file from a security standpoint that I always thought was, it was about making sure you didn't have someone on the bench who had issues that would cause them to be blackmailable or subject to the lure of money because they were deeply in debt or something. Right. And so the blackmailability question for the FBI was like, do they have a record of debt? Do they have a problem where they're a gambling problem where they're trying to get money, you know, that they need to pay off debts? Do they have other, are they, you know, have a drug problem where basically they're, you know, it's again, this question of money and risk. And so that's the type of thing that the FBI file would in theory illuminate if it like those financial documents would reveal that. And so with Kavanaugh, like, there's the financial disclosure forms as a sitting judge to disclose loans and things of that nature, gifts, travel, and the like. And then there's the FBI background investigation that's supposed to illuminate if you have had debt, like your credit report basically is in there, and you know what's your situation. And so it's a completely 100% legitimate question for whether you're on the highest court in the country or the lowest court in the country. Are you at risk of, you know, someone basically paying off your debts for you in order to get a favor or favorable treatment? Are you someone who has a record of, you know, gambling that would be embarrassing that you could be blackmailed over in order to get a decision that someone likes? I mean, these are real questions about the administration of justice. And so the fact that this cloud continues to exist over Kavanaugh, you know, and then we see what else has happened with the court and the lack of any real meaningful enforcement, no real ethics enforcement at all, et cetera. There's just this cloud of corruption around this court. And Thomas is obviously part of that, as you know well, and have written about. But Alito too, and Scalia was a frequent flyer on the gravy train of corruption. Mm-hmm. And then you have John Roberts, who has done nothing about it, nothing real. It's just optics.
I want to talk about Roberts, but in a second, I want to close the loop here on Kavanaugh, because I went back and read about it because I just hadn't been paying attention to it lately. And I had forgotten about the whole baseball tickets thing. You remember that?
Yeah,
just for people listening who may have forgotten, his claim about how he got money was that he would charge, or, you know, to pay off his credit card, he would charge season tickets for the Washington Nationals. And he would buy tickets for this group of friends that he had, and then they would all pay him back, and he would use the money to pay off the debt. And it's so cockamamie, it makes no sense at all, because you can see from the financial disclosures that he was already in pretty heavy credit card debt. And why would you get the guy that's heavy in credit card debt and use his credit card to buy these season tickets to a baseball for a baseball team, which, by the way, if you're that heavy in debt, why are you buying season tickets to a baseball? You know, why would you do that?
Right.
It's completely irresponsible, right. To say nothing of anything else. And everybody just sort of went along with this. Like, this was perfectly, you know, a reasonable kind of thing. But it like, you know, sometimes if I was cash poor when I was living in New York, you'd go out to dinner, I'd put dinner on my credit card and my four friends would give me cash. And then you know, I have cash. Right, this seemed like right.
It's a way to generate cash.
A way to generate cash. It's almost impossible to trace depending on how many people are in this pool. And I don't know. It's just something else I wanted to bring up because like in your position, reading through financial disclosures, would that be something that would make you stop and be like, wait, what? That's weird.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, it is really strange. And also like when you think of that group of friends, at least the description of them, some of them were already well off, kind of born on third base sort of stuff. Like, why is he fronting their tickets? And also the other part of that, you know, was puzzling to me, is again, on this question of like, his dad is extremely wealthy. Like, why is he in credit card debt? And he's already paid a substantial amount on the bench. And so the things just do not add up. It does not add up. And the fact that it just sort of got lost in the wash or people let it go, you know, it's disturbing because it evinces a pattern of behavior that I would consider to be, you know, troubling and risky for someone in a position of power, someone in a position where they might need money. They seem to have some issues that they might need more money than they're getting or that they're getting from their dad, for example, you know.
But even with the dad, there's something else I just remembered. Even with the dad thing, he's not on the mortgage. You can't get a mortgage just because your parents are rich. Yeah, you know, the bank isn't going to be like, well, you can't afford this, but well, your dad has a lot of money, so why not? You know, that's not how banks work. And he didn't list his dad there. And also, if his dad has all this money, just buy the fucking house outright. Just buy it and have it. And you have the mortgage. Why bother the whole thing? Which speaks to the, I don't think he, you know, it's logical that he might, but why would it be structured this way? It's just the whole thing is very strange.
Related thing is that if you do give a gift or get a gift, there are disclosure rules for the IRS. Like, it's not just that it's in a vacuum. Mm. Like the bank rule you point out in terms of the mortgage, like that's one thing. You can't have a secret cosigner, a secret non-cosigner whose credit miraculously gets you the mortgage, but the bank doesn't have any security with them. Like, that's not normal.
Yeah.
But the other piece is if there were substantial gifts, $250,000 or what have you, that's the type of gift that would have to be disclosed under IRS rules typically. Now, there are some exceptions. I think they changed the rules somewhere in this stream. Like, can you, you know, the IRS rules are things that are mysteries to me in a certain sense as an ordinary person. Like, you could give a gift up to $1 million to someone and, you know, that, you know, somehow that would be fine in certain circumstances. You have to disclose it. But other types of gifts do have to be disclosed. So there's complexity there. It reminds me a little bit of the campaign finance rules where even in the current environment where we've got all this dark money pulsing through the electoral system, you know, an ordinary person could never max out. It's like your whole salary, you can spend your entire take-home salary for most Americans, average American income, you know, $40,000 to $60,000 to $70,000 or what have you, would never max out on the campaign finance rules. So there are ways in which the numbers, like maybe there was not an IRS violation, but it's just a lot. It's a lot of money. A lot of money for ordinary people, and it's a lot of money for someone in his position, given how much money he was bringing in as a judge.
Yeah. Also, the house was a piece of shit and a money pit, per his testimony. That was the other thing that was funny.
It
was a money pit, which he then had to spend more money to try to fix up the house. And I'll say we'll just throw it out there. He did expressly deny ever having gambled at all in any way, shape, or form. He was asked that specifically, explicitly, and he said no. So that means, you know, he's not even like playing fantasy football for you know, a small pot. So just to throw that out.
Yeah, I mean, my observation in the broader world is given the legalization of gambling and more over time, that would be an outlier for most Americans to have never wagered once.
It's ridiculous. Anyway, okay, so I want to get to John Roberts because now you have written or you're writing a book about John Roberts.
I am writing, have not written.
Okay. You are writing, have not written. Okay. So, which is great because I think there should be a good, you know, definitive kind of book about this guy. He was the first kind of Supreme Court justice to go through the confirmation process, I guess, after I left college when I was sort of more aware of what was happening in the world. So I watched the confirmation hearing, which I'd never done before, probably up until that point. And I remember thinking, oh, this guy's like really smart. And, you know, okay, yeah, he's a conservative, whatever. But like, you know, we want smart people on the bench. We don't want dopes. And this guy's clearly qualified for the job. Therefore, the Senate really has to confirm him because he's qualified, which is all the Senate is supposed to do is qualify him. But then he goes in and he kind of just sucks. Like, and he wasn't the Chief Justice, if I remember correctly, until later, until the second one, Bush decided to make him the Chief Justice. And then the next one, which at first it was going to be Harriet Myers, and that then it wound up being, I guess, Alito. So he moved it around a little bit. So my first question is, what's the deal with being Chief Justice? Like, is it that much more powerful? Is it really you get to set the tone for the whole thing? And why is it that arbitrary that we assign one dude this job and they just get to keep it for 60 years? Like, it seems ridiculous.
Yeah. So I worked on the Roberts nomination when he was nominated to the D.C. Circuit, and I tried my best to keep him off the D.C. Circuit. I failed in that effort. I used to say that the best thing that ever happened to John Roberts was that Bill Clinton became president, because he could spend 8 years palling around with all these partners at these law firms and doing this little nod of pro bono on one environmental case, that he could get some environmentalists to say, oh, he's not so bad. He did a moot court with us and helped us. When I looked at his resume, it was like a talking points resume of a talking point against his actual dominant theme of his career, that he would have at least one pro bono environmental helping thing, you know, or one pro bono thing on choice that he could pretend like he was not, didn't have the designs of somehow overturning Roe in his scope. So, as a result of that, trying to make sure people understood the risk that he posed, I really was convinced that if Bush had the opportunity, and if he chose a white guy for the job, it was going to be John Roberts, that he was the person that they were going to try to put on the U.S. Supreme Court. And so I asked my boss and to ask Senator Daschle and Senator Reid to not have a recorded vote on him. And usually we would have recorded votes on the nominees. Instead, he went through by unanimous consent by UC, because I was concerned that the earliest vacancy, which we thought was going to be Rehnquist, because he was not in great health, they would elevate John Roberts. And if the members had just voted affirmatively for him, it would be very hard for them to vote against him, you know, a year later. So I didn't want them locked into that vote. So of course he went by UC, and then they said, but he was unanimously confirmed. But it was designed to try to protect what happened. And as you point out, he was initially nominated for the vacated seat by Justice O'Connor, and then Rehnquist died. So then Bush named him to Rehnquist's seat, and then Bush tried to name Harriet Myers, his longtime lawyer from Texas, but Leonard Lee objected. She wasn't right-wing enough. She wasn't doctrinaire enough. He didn't want another suitor. This was the no more suitors thing. So they rolled her and got her withdrawn and swapped in Alito, who was a sure thing in their extreme agenda and Leo's extreme agenda. And that's how we got there. But this idea of, like, why should someone be the chief justice for, you know, for decades? It is just a sort of a default of the way our confirmation process works, but it has significant power. So for example, the chief justice chooses the head of the administrative office of the U.S. courts, the office that I worked in. Mm-hmm. He chooses or can choose all the people who sit on these committees, the technology committee, the evidence committee, all the committees that set policy within the court system. The one committee that he can't designate is the judicial conference, because those are the chief judges of each of the circuits, but he helms it. So he sets the tone for even that committee, which has been embroiled in an absolute failure to act in the face of documented corruption by Justice Thomas with these gifts that he's received. Failure to hold him accountable a decade ago, failure to hold him accountable now, and that's on Roberts. Roberts helms that committee. So it is an important role within the administration of justice, the federal court system. It's on Roberts that this corruption has been allowed to take place, that he's done nothing about it, and that he this ethics code that he unveiled late last year, timed to try to prevent a subpoena issued to Leonard Leo and Harlan Crow. That timing stank. But when he unveiled it, he said, these are the rules we've already always been, people just don't understand, we've always operated on those rules. And our response was, yeah, we understand that these rules have no actual impact on the integrity of our court, because they're clearly violated on a regular basis. So, this Roberts court that began, you know, almost 20 years ago, I mean, who's nominated now 20 years ago next year, this Roberts court this chapter in American law, in American policy, is a deeply destructive one of destroying core precedents, Roe being one of them, but also the Citizens United case, the attack on the Voting Rights Act, which Roberts himself wrote, the attack on the ability of lower federal court judges to do anything about this grotesque partisan minoritarianism through map making so that a minority can retain power even when a majority of the people in the state vote Democratic. The gun policy changes that they've made have been just atrocious and horrifying. And that's the Roberts Court. The Roberts Court has also in its sights our environmental laws, our ability to mitigate climate change. You can see that in the EPA case from a year and a half ago. And now these cases that are pending on Chevron to try to basically allow these judges to supplant the expertise of agencies with their own non-expert views, especially a bench that now has been packed by so many partisans and people who are barely qualified or, you know, have barely been a lawyer for a decade, but whose main qualification is that they're aligned with Leonard Leo and his extreme agenda, that they're part of the Federal Society, or they've otherwise been political operatives. It's just extraordinary. And Roberts is at the helm of the court system, and he has gotten away, in my view, with the statement that he made to the American people that he would just be an umpire calling balls and strikes. He is on the field. He is a player on the field. He's not been a neutral umpire, and he has failed in that promise that he made, which I think was not accurate at the time, since I had opposed him, you know, before then. But it certainly has been proven to be an inaccurate statement over these past several years.
Yeah, there hasn't been this corrupt an umpire since Leslie Nielsen and Naked Gun. So
yes. Nicely done, Greg. Yes.
Why did you object to him way back when? Was it just because the environmental stuff, or because you could see he was just like pandering a little bit here and there to people, and you were, or is it because he's smart and you were worried?
Well, so he'd worked in the Reagan administration. The writings that I could see of his, we didn't have his full set of records, but we had a substantial amount of his writings. They look a lot like Heritage Foundation writings to me. He was clearly smart, but he was very doctrinaire. Mm. He also worked for Ken Starr on the Rust case and other anti-abortion cases during the George Herbert Walker Bush administration. He had signaled, in my view, that he was not going to be fair on environmental law. That he was a movement operative, basically, and that he would use the courts to advance that agenda. And I thought that he was particularly going to be particularly challenging because even though he had clerked for Rehnquist, back in the early 1980s. Rehnquist was known as the Lone Ranger before he became the Chief Justice, before Reagan made him the Chief Justice in the mid-1980s. He would dissent. Rehnquist was someone, I could tell you more about Rehnquist, but Rehnquist was someone who had a deeply regressive background, even though he had a couple areas where he, you know, was not the worst on the issue. And certainly Thomas has, you know, been far beyond him in some ways. But Rehnquist was terrible on so many issues, but he wasn't interested in persuading his fellow judges, or at least he wasn't very effective at persuading his fellow judges. Didn't have charm, although he, you know, had some musical ability, I guess, at the Christmas party and was, you know, funny or something, you know, the same way that Scalia was funny, but so what if you're going to destroy our rights? Like, I don't care how funny you are. Yeah. I don't care how sincere you are about destroying my rights just because you're funny. Like, it doesn't make a difference. But Rehnquist was not known for necessarily being able to persuade people to go along with his dissents, in essence.
And it's pretty funny that he's Roberts, a lawyer.
Yeah.
Isn't that like
the
job?
That Robert, yeah. Well, to persuade, right? I mean, he was just more like doctrinaire in that way. So like, yeah, this is just the way it is, you know, right? So I thought that Roberts would be more charming, would be more charming to the public and to other justices in his agenda in terms of trying to destroy our rights in so many ways.
Well, you called it. You were right. So good for you. Get your flowers. The country's fucked.
One of my friends on Senate Judiciary called me the day he was nominated, and he said you were right. And I just am so sorry. I was right. Like, this is the time I would have preferred to be the most wrong.
I didn't really. I mean, it was the impeachment, I think, that really did it for me. Like, that pushed me over the. And again, I don't watch this stuff closely, but that he had the ability during that impeachment in the Constitution, as I understand it, he had a tremendous leeway to make that into something. And he chose to just sit there and just look at his phone or whatever the fuck he was doing, as if he was irritated that he had to participate at all.
Yep.
And to me, that's such an abrogation of responsibility, of of the utmost responsibility. Like, there's nothing more important that he could possibly be doing than that. I guess, was he figuring out how to pay for Washington Nationals tickets to go in with Brett? I don't know what he was doing. What did you think about that when that was going on? And did you, was that something you might have foreseen, or was that surprising to you how he behaved?
I was surprised by his affect. In those moments, I wasn't surprised that the way he chose to try to confine that role, given that his thumb is on the scale of justice for the Republican Party, basically at nearly every turn, even though he, issued that statement, there are no Republican judges, there are no Democratic judges, despite all evidence to the contrary in terms of his agenda and the agenda of his faction that now dominates the court. But it was disappointing because he certainly has like free will. He could choose to take a different course of action. He could choose, and it's not as though, in essence, the court has agreed with everything Trump has done. Like, there have been a couple areas where they've drawn the line, but for the most part, I don't have any confidence that this court would stand up to a second Trump administration, or if they managed to, out of some miracle, there were, five votes against him, so that Trump would even follow it, that he would follow any rule against him. And I think there's two things that just happened recently that were just stunning. One was, to rewrite the 14th Amendment, the third clause of it, to say that it requires, or at least to assert that there's a unanimous view on the court that the 14th Amendment requires an implementing statute in order to bar someone from office for engaging in insurrection, when in fact, you don't have to be an originalist, so-called originalist or what have you, but you read it, that clause says that people who engage in insurrection are barred from office. And it has one escape clause. Congress, by a two-thirds vote, can remove that impediment. So it's the opposite of requiring implementation. In fact, the only thing that requires implementation is if you want to remove that bar, then two-thirds of Congress have to remove it. And so it was totally counterfactual, countertextual. And then it turns out that it wasn't really a unanimous decision on that point. The only unanimity was that they didn't want to let Colorado be the only state basically to take Trump from the ballot and what that would cause, which, by the way, if they're concerned about one state deciding a presidential election, hello, Bush v. Gore and Florida. If that's actually a constitutional impediment, I'd like to know that that was the case, since it doesn't apply to Republicans, apparently. But the reality is that it was really five votes for that claim. And in fact, it was four, because Thomas had no business sitting on that case, since Jenny Thomas had actively engaged in trying to support the blocking of the certification election and had actively sought out legislators in Wisconsin and Arizona. These are on the record documents that are now in the public record of her role in trying to solicit the effort to thwart the certification of the votes in our election. And she was there on January 6th, claimed she left early because it was cold. I'd like to see the paper trail on that, some documentation that's true. I don't believe it. I know she said it under oath. I don't believe it, in my opinion. But, I just think that this court, in deciding that case that way, and Roberts helped orchestrate that, and then had it go like with the cowardice of it being an unsigned opinion, is also just total disrespect for the American people under the circumstances. And then to follow that up with taking that D.C. Circuit case on the immunity claim, which is a laugh out loud, like Rule 11 violation, if I ever saw it, sort of claim of. Presidential immunity that transcends all bounds of law. And they took that case, at least four of the justices on that court took that case, even though that was a 2-1 panel, it was a 3-0 panel, but it was at least one Republican appointee was on that panel, Judge Henderson. And it was a powerfully written decision about why Trump's immunity claims were so baseless. The easiest thing for the Supreme Court to have done would have been to not take that case, to deny cert. But they chose to take it. So I fear the mischief either from the delay or from some effort by the Alito and Thomas wing of the court to concoct a completely outlandish assertion, ahistorical, inconsistent with law assertion of immunity for Trump, who they seem very much aligned with.
I mean, if they decide that the president is above the law and has immunity from everything, Biden's still the president for the next, you know, until January, no matter what happens. So be careful what you wish for, gentlemen. That's it. You know, better be careful.
Yeah, it's that oral argument, the idea that, you know, first of all, as you know, Greg, that they claimed during impeachment that he couldn't be impeached if he wasn't convicted. Then when he's being tried, they say that he can't be convicted if he hasn't been impeached. It's just this completely circular, outlandish argument. But then in that oral argument for his lawyer to go along with this notion that he could even assassinate a political opponent or numerous political opponents, unless he was impeached for it, he couldn't be tried for it, is the definition of lawlessness. It doesn't surprise me because the attorney who was arguing for him has been involved in these very radical reactionary anti-choice efforts, including, you know, at least at one point, some state that was attempting to monitor periods of women, of young girls, athletes, and the like. So this is it's a regressive regime, but it's a regime they envision that is utterly inconsistent with the Constitution or and the longstanding traditions of America as a nation bound by the rule of law and not men, not a person that can just defy our Constitution, defy our laws. So it's horrifying and outrageous. And yet the court has taken this case. We'll see what they do.
It is outrageous. And I've often thought about this with regards, can a sitting president be tried for, and it depends on what he violates or she, you know, if right. It's a, even with Trump, if he really did murder somebody on Fifth Avenue, I think I would like to think that they would actually just arrest him and treat him like somebody else who would do such a thing and not be like, well, I don't know, the president, no, no, no. Some of the other, like the immunity for the president idea, the concept of it, as I understand it, is to insulate the person doing the job from the consequences of acting in that position in a way that might later on be illegal. Like W. Bush,
right?
What he did during the Iraq, you know, during the wars of terror, did he break certain laws? Were things, yes, but if he wasn't the president, he wouldn't have been doing that. You know, he was put in the position where he had to make judgment calls. The judgment calls were bad, but I don't think that he went in there thinking, I'm going to do this so I can get oil. Like, I just don't believe that. With Trump, it's not that. It's not something he did as president. He's just stealing stuff or whatever. Like, you can't do these things whether you're president or not. It has nothing to do with him being president or the job itself forcing him into these things. Does that make sense? And am I understanding it?
It does.
Yeah.
It does. And I also think, you know, I'm very skeptical about judicial invention of immunity in a variety of settings. We've seen that with police officers, the way that so-called qualified immunity has allowed so many people to not be held accountable for killing people who are unarmed by the notion, this judicial invention of qualified immunity, rather than allowing the jury to assess. I suspect that in many instances, because of, you know, people's concerns, you know, for public safety, that they might not hold those police accountable, even if I wish that they were held accountable in a particular instance. But this judicial invention of immunity, it's not part of the Constitution. It's not something that's mandated. But there are, as you point out, some rationales for not having a president sort of hailed into court to be personally liable for a policy decision that he or she has discretion to make. And yet, for example, for January 6th, that's not a policy decision a president has discretion to make. This is part of our Constitution, that the votes are counted, that the votes are certified, that you know, he can't just stay in power because he has invented a rationale for himself. And then there's the, like you said, there's the sort of pre-presidential activity. You're going to be a president, then every crime you committed in the past no longer counts. Then you're a president, then anything you do, even if it's not within the bounds of your office, like a policy discretion, you get immunity for, like, that's not actually how it really works in reality. Post-presidential behavior, like, you have that Trump in the words of Cash, or the kind of suggestion of Cash Patel, who in my view should never be allowed to have any security clearance whatsoever in any form, in any place, to assert that the president could just, like, think with his magic brain and declassify a room of documents secretly and no one knows, but they just by the power of his, you know, blinking his eyes suddenly, like I Dream of Jeannie. They're all like, classified. I've now shown my age by referencing I Dream of Jeannie. They have a completely fictional conception of what a president can do. Oh, a president's just going to order that people who are lawful permanent residents just be rounded up, from different background, like, you know, I mean, for a party, let me just say my personal capacity along all these Trump lines, but for a party that claims to be focused on the rule of law, they don't seem to be much bothered by it, by what the law commands or what the Constitution says, the so-called originalists or what have you. And so I like to think that if Trump were to shoot someone on Fifth Avenue, that he would be arrested immediately. But I also think has committed serious crimes, in my opinion, based on the evidence that's been presented in these 91 criminal counts. And I think he can and must be held accountable for those crimes if he's proven guilty. And they say this is unprecedented for a president to be prosecuted. What's unprecedented for a president to commit such crimes?
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Exactly. That's a specious argument because duh.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't want your president to be prosecuted, don't elect a criminal. It's really that simple.
Right.
It's
right. Right. Or as they say, if you can't do the time, don't do the crime. You know, that's I always heard that growing up, you know?
That's the time to sweat is before the bet. As Brett Kavanaugh might say. I don't want to keep you too long, so I have like 30 more. I don't have that many, but so I'll let you pick what you want to go out on. We could talk about Merrick Garland, we could talk about Clarence and Ginny, we can talk about Kamala Harris visiting the Planned Parenthood clinic.
Let's talk about Clarence and Ginny. About Clarence and Ginny because I think, you know, Heidi Presbyla from Politico did a number of really important stories about Leo and Ginny and Thomas. But the story investigated last fall, I think it was about how during the Citizens United case, as that case was pending before the court, Ginny was working with Cleta Mitchell, who's now famous, to create a nonprofit to take advantage of the decision that had not yet been issued by her husband and the other justices to create this thing called Liberty Central. That the timeline that Heidi wrote about shows that on New Year's Eve, Ginny rushes out, you know, to get expedited approval for this corporation. There's no scenario in which she's not talking to her best friend Clarence Thomas about her organization that she's rushing to get approved on New Year's Eve, or that his benefactor, their benefactor, had just given her $500,000, staked her for this organization. So here they come in early January of 2010, and he sits on a 5-4 decision to destroy these campaign finance rules, the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, otherwise known as McCain-Feingold. He did not recuse himself, even though his billionaire buddy had just staked his wife's organization with a $500,000 gift to help pay her salary. That decision was illegitimate at the time in the way it rewrote our First Amendment to try to protect from reasonable disclosure rules, spending before elections by these sort of C4 groups, like Ginny was creating C3, C4 groups. But the fact that he had the audacity to sit on that case and that she had the audacity to launch an organization to take advantage of it is just extraordinary. And then by the end of that year, after she ends up in some hot water for this call to Anita Hill demanding her apology, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and public outcry once they learned that she was involved in this group, not knowing that Harlan Crow had staked it before the case was even issued, she leaves Liberty Central. And who's there to help her? Leonard Leo, who was on the board of Liberty Central for her, and who, as the Washington Post reported also last year, had secretly arranged to pay Ginny tens of thousands of dollars from a secret source through a group called the Judicial Education Project, which is a sibling of this Judicial Crisis Network that we all know about, or many people know about. And so just that was a massive amount of corruption over a decade ago, and it has just continued in various ways. But I tell that story because it's not just the corruption of this money coming in from a secretive billionaire to help feather your nest. it's also clearly affecting the decisions of the court. No matter what Leo may say or Thomas's apologist may say that he would have ruled that way anyway. Well, you don't get to take the bribe just because you're going to rule that way. You still don't get to take the money. I was going to authorize that shopping mall down by the highway anyway, so I could take the gold bars or whatever, not to get too far into this other hornet's nest. But you don't get to say I was going to do it, so I get to take the cash. Or my wife gets to get $500,000 to stake her organization and get a, $100,000 salary out of it. And then when that thing fails for her, someone just happens to come up with another $100,000 salary for her. Thank you, Leonard Leo, secretly. And then Leo's answer was basically, I was just helping my friend. Well, how much has he helped his friend? Like if he did it that one time, which I don't, they told Politico, they did not answer questions. It's in the story about whether it continued. The easiest thing for them to say was it stopped. We only did it then. So it may well continue in various forms or have continued for years. And the Senate has to investigate this. Those subpoenas have to go out. The other committees need to also take a look at it. It is just, in my view, rank corruption. And ultimately, I hope that Clarence Thomas is impeached and that there's a much further investigation into this corruption that just has engulfed the U.S. Supreme Court. So thanks for letting me.
No, say thank
that
you for,
is my yeah, yeah.
I'm glad that you went off on that because I've been really trying to wrap my mind around this guy and his wife for some time now because he's just it's almost admirable the way he's managed to get money from all these different sources. You're always like, geez, look, you made as much money as a Supreme Court justice can possibly make. I mean, on some level, I tip my hat to you for and if this is the system. If the system is this awful and this bad at ethics and there's no teeth to any of these regs, those were the rules. Scalia, your buddy, explained to you that this is how it works, and you took it to the extremes. But
there was a ProPublica story that was at the end of the last year that sort of illuminated that, as you know, which is that he was telling people in 99, 2000, yeah. 2000, that he wasn't making enough to live the lifestyle that he wanted, mm-hmm. That they needed to raise his salary. And so we have that now we know the origin story of this is that he wanted to live the lifestyle of a law firm partner while doing the job of a Supreme Court justice. And these billionaires have come in, like you said, this host of billionaires willing to help pay for his private jet travel and his private yacht travel and his, vacation.
And his mom's dishwasher. Oh my God. It's just,
yeah. It's just extraordinary. But as you point out, like the fact that this has been allowed and there's been no consequence yet, on the one hand, I suppose maybe even Trump has some sort of like wants to take some notes from
right.
Clarence Thomas on how to get this stuff done. But it's just not what a fair court system should look like.
No, I mean, I'm joking about it a little bit, but it's disgraceful. Somebody in Europe or elsewhere in the world looking at our system of justice must just be like, what the fuck are these guys doing? How could anything that this court rules on be taken seriously at this point? And that's the problem really here is we're getting into a point where the court is so far removed from what people in the country want, what we collectively feel ethically and what the actual laws say, that it's bordering on being irrelevant. And I think that's why you see like Sotomayor and Coney Barrett going off together and trying to play nice, right. To make sure that people don't lose faith in the court. The only thing that's going to save it is they have to expand it, and they have to expand it not two. They need to put like eight more people in there or something, because the more people that are in there, the harder it is for one rich fucking asshole to corrupt it. And, and then if Clarence is still there, he loses power and maybe they stop giving him money because he doesn't have so much power. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a host of reforms that need to be pursued because this cannot be allowed to continue. We cannot have this broken system. And that's one of the reasons why I've been really excited to partner with Alex Aronson, who, worked for Senator Whitehouse on Senate Judiciary Committee as his chief counsel and who's been thinking about the advocacy component of this. I work on research and analysis of what's happening with the court and like you said, what can be done to fix this. And Alex is just brilliant and has been working with a number of colleagues and allied organizations to try to really move forward knowledge of what's happening and that we have the power to fix it and that we have to fix it. Yeah.
Yeah. I love Alex. He's been on the show. He's fantastic. So people listening to the show know well who he is and what he's been up to. And again, I'm grateful to you. I'm grateful to him. I'm grateful to you. I'm grateful to Hyde. I'm grateful to everybody who's out there, on the front lines of this, trying to make a difference, because I think most people don't know what's happening with this stuff. And it's terrifying. And a Trump victory or Trump's reinstallation in after a loss, which would be worse in some sense, the country is going to be unrecognizable by, I don't know, like Easter of 2025. I mean, when stuff falls, it falls fast. So I think what we want to do is.
Yeah. And mentioning 2025, given the fact that they have basically pledged through this Project 2025 that mm-hmm. Heritage and 100 other right-wing groups have put forward, that if he were to win at the moment of this end of the swearing in, they would start implementing this radical reactionary agenda, so extreme. And then it's not just the substance of that agenda in terms of rolling back the clock a century or more. It's also, I don't think that we would ever have another real election for president, because there's no way Trump would leave. He's shown that he would not. He barely left the last time. There's no way he would leave on his own will again. You know?
Yeah. No. He doesn't leave. These fuckers never leave. BB won't leave. Putin won't leave. Well, Putin's going to win re-election again, I guess, after this weekend.
Yeah, by some historic margin that's completely made up.
Putin won't leave. Trump won't leave. Rudy Giuliani tried to not leave New York City, Gracie Mansion, after serving the two terms.
Yeah.
He tried to make it so that he could serve a third term. And New York City said, fuck off, which is, that was good.
Yeah.
But they don't like to leave. Therefore we have to, now that we've gotten this vampire out of the building, we need to keep him out of the building, I say.
Yeah.
So
I agree in my personal capacity. Yes, indeed. Yes. Yeah.
So where can we find you? Where can people find you?
I am still on Twitter and on Threads at the Lisa Graves, because I, in one of my non-prescient moments, I didn't think Twitter was going to be a thing, because I thought, who wants to know what I'm thinking about as I'm standing in line for coffee? Not that they want to know what I'm thinking about as I'm standing in line for coffee, but I didn't think it was going to be such a hit, or I would have been had Lisa Graves, but it's the Lisa Graves. And our website is truenorthresearch.org, all one word, truenorthresearch.org. And then you can see some of our work in stories. I've got a story coming out from the Progressive magazine. And then hopefully I'll have a chance to talk with you again before the book next year, or many times perhaps, if you'll have me anytime, Greg. But it's a delight to be on your show, and hope find me here on this show for now, this segment. Yeah.
Thank you so much for hanging out with me today. As always, it's a pleasure. And I really learned a lot today. So Lisa Graves. I'm so bad at the end of this. I'm so bad at this. I never know what
Thanks,
to say.
Greg. I'm honored to be on your show. It's so nice of you to ask me. Thank you.
The Prevail theme song is by Matthew Fawcett. Serena Zabriskie, Marie Cast, and Martha Acuna provided the introduction in Ukrainian, French, and Spanish, respectively. Voice talent is by Stephanie St. John and me. Thanks to Allison Gill, Molly Hawkey, Kenai Williams, Kimberly Johnson, and everyone else at MSW Media. If you'd like to support this program, get three friends to subscribe. The more downloads I get, the better the show does. You can also subscribe to The 5-8, the live YouTube show I do with my friend Stephanie Koff, a.k.a. LB. Tune in tonight for your Friday night hang. Most importantly, please subscribe to The Prevail Substack, with updates every Tuesday, Friday, and Sunday. Your $6 monthly or $55 yearly subscription funds my work on the column and the podcast. Visit gregoliar.com to learn more. Thanks for listening. Drive safely, be kind to each other, try and enjoy yourself, and until next time, we shall prevail.
MSW Media.
I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life?
The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of The Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.